動でお風呂を沸かします。
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Covent Garden. My name is Dan Schreiber. I am sitting here with James Harkin, Anna Tashinsky, and Andrew Hunter Murray. And once again, we have gathered round the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is Anna.
My fact this week is that indigenous Bolivian women traditionally wear huge, colourful skirts and bowler hats. And I can't believe I'd never really seen this before. Yeah. It's striking. And they all do. So these are, they tend to be known as cholitas, which is basically a term for like the Aymara and the Quechua and other rural Bolivian women.
Not Charlie Chaplin. As it sort of sounds like, the Charlitas.
It's a, I know you're trying to make the jump to the Charlie Chaplin bowler hat, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, so like his fan club, you know, yeah. Like all these like Lady Gagas are called
Beliebers.
Little monsters.
Yeah.
Maybe you've blown this wide open, and that is why they do it. So Charlitas, it used to be a pejorative term, I think, and it comes from the Spanish cholo for mixed race, but it's like very much reclaimed by them now. And if you look them up, they always wear these stunning kind of white, like silky waistcoats with a brooch and these huge dresses with like petticoats underneath, so like really big Elizabethan style dresses, and then a bowler hat which doesn't fit,
but it does work. It makes the look awesome.
It works because bowler hats were originally invented to stop twigs from hurting your head, weren't they? So I wondered if
it would probably stop a twig from hurting your head.
It's not functional.
I'm talking fashion. Yeah. I'm saying works.
That works.
Okay. Yeah.
It does work.
It does.
Yes. And we're not quite sure why they do it. They started doing it at the turn of the 20th century. There's the legend that when British and Irish railway workers were in Bolivia, which they were because the railway building company was a British company, there was a big shipment of bowler hats that was sent to for them to wear because it was like workers' hats and they were too small. So some clever marketing person flogged them to the indigenous women. I think there was a guy called Domingo Solingo who did a very good job of popularizing them and ran a good PR campaign.
Try to get men to wear it first from one of the other stories, versions of the story, and they were just not interested. So they just, as a last minute thing, went, women? Would you like
women? Then when he was walking along with a tray of samples one day, he tripped over and one of the hats fell onto a woman's head and completely by accident, he discovered.
That's so interesting because they are, I mean, they are comically small. They're not like, you know, just a little bit too small to go on your head, are they?
They're not like yarmulke, if you're picturing. It's like,
they're clearly too small.
They sit on top.
They sit on top.
So, who were they made for is my question.
Yes. We have this in the house all the time where you order something and then a novelty small size version comes in the post. That must be what it was. You know, like we bought a crown for my son Wilf's birthday and it arrived and it was the size that would fit a Ken doll's head by accident because we just hadn't read the measurements.
You
so we got a washing line. Need to read the measurements. They clearly didn't hear as well.
One thing I like about the Cholita thing is that I didn't know anything about this style before, or even this cultural grouping before researching this, but they weren't allowed to walk freely in the main square of La Paz, which is the capital of Bolivia, or in the wealthy suburbs in this outfit for many years. And then it's really been brought back on board to the extent that they're officially a part of the city's cultural heritage now. It's called the Cholita of La Paz. And also, there are Cholita fashion shows. There is a Cholita modeling agency. And I'm sure you guys came across the Fighting Cholitas.
I'd like to hear about
the Fighting Cholitas.
It's just a wrestling group, but they're female wrestlers who wrestle in traditional...
With the hat.
With the hats.
Do they do like odd job?
The odd job kill.
They do. They die by the dozen every match. Anyway, the Fighting Cholitas.
That's the one where they play golf, isn't it?
God.
Yeah, that's the only Bond film I've seen, the one where they play golf.
Did you Google Bond film golf?
I just Googled golf and it came up.
Right. Do you have... You know there's an app that can tell you when to go to the toilet at the cinema, like toilet break. Do you you have an app that just tells you when golf scenes are in a movie
and
you just show up for that bit?
I do. I only ever watch Caddyshack and that Bond film.
They are a real happy story, which, you know, we're all on the lookout for these days. But I think it was basically since Evo Morales was in charge of Bolivia, right, who was their first indigenous president, who came in the early 2000s and sort of completely rehabilitated their reputations because they had been kind of ostracized and had all these horrible repressive rules made against them. And now they're doing so well, and it's a real great story, and they're quite well off. They've got all these celebrations about their heritage. They have, I think they have a few indigenous people in parliament. They're like lawyers and doctors, and yeah, it's quite nice because they have, since like literally back in the day when the Spanish colonized, and they wanted to distinguish them, the superior colonists, from the indigenous people. So they said, okay, well, what do people who are lower class do in Spain? They wear these big peasant dresses. And so they made them all wear these big peasant dresses. So yeah, they say, put them in these, to say, like, you're beneath us. And the Cholitas just went, all right, we're going to own this. Yeah.
It's interesting because like the big dresses come from the Spanish peasants and the bowler hats come from British, you know, upper class people.
Yeah. Right,
it's
yeah,
such a fusion.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Have you guys ever drunk Coca-Cola?
No.
Yes.
What kind of a question
You might
is that?
Be right. You might be right that you haven't. So this launched in April 2010 and Coca-Cola, spelled Cola, C-O-L-L-A.
Coca-Cola.
Yeah, is a local Coca-Cola, basically, that they've just manufactured on their own. So it has a red label with white writing. I mean, it's the packaging is very similar, but it's sold as a legit product there. They've not been in trouble. And
they're all right with this, or are we now getting them in trouble if someone
listening? It's becoming a bigger
because it's named after the color people,
exactly,
and the coca nut which is in it.
Yeah,
And they say to Coca-Cola or Britvic or whoever owns Coca-Cola, they say, well, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. And I'm not sure Coca-Cola are particularly happy about it, but there's nothing they can
do. They're definitely not happy about it, no, but they can do fuck all. And they've got coca leaf extracts in it as well. So actually, it's an illegal drink to be sold over here. So they're quite regional because it's legal there. But for us, it's a drug.
I think we should legalize. I mean, we should probably legalize all drugs, but coca leaves, I definitely think we should legalize in this country.
So we can get this cola drink?
No, because like when I was in the Andes, it's the best thing. It just gives you a little bit of a pickup.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so useful. Honestly, when you've got a hangover or you're tired or anything, just chew a coca leaf and it just makes you feel so much better. Well, it's just, it's just tried, a tiny little buzz.
Have you tried cocaine, James? You'll love it.
I think the Pope has tried the coca leaves.
Has he?
I think he visited several years ago. And when he went, I think he said, I'll have some of that. So
they're everywhere. Like if you go to a hotel, you know, if you go to a hotel in the UK, they might have a bowl of Murray mints.
Oh, a lovely hotel would have that. Yeah
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, all the hotels in Peru and in Bolivia, they have a bowl of these leaves, and you just pick them up
bowl,
and chew on them.
It's a bowler hat upside down, isn't it? Full of those leaves.
Are you sure it's not just potpourri? You've been munching away
because it leaves your breath really, really nice at the end of it.
Guys, did you know? Not 25 minutes walk from where we're sitting right now is where the first bowler hats were sold.
Wow. Is that true?
Yeah.
Invented and sold in St. James's Street. I mean, it might have been invented in someone's house, you know, but it was brought to St. James's Street to Lock and Co. Hatters, who've been going since, like, basically the 17th century when they were founded. And the shop is still there today, so you can still buy hats from them.
Yeah. I walk past there quite a lot.
Do you? Yeah. Right, so that's where the bowler hat is from.
That's very exciting.
That is exciting, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're going to turn up next week in a bowler hat? Because I can see it, of the four of us.
Just a comically small one, I think.
Yeah. No, that's a really... It's a nice shop. I don't think they make a huge deal out of it on the shop front.
No, they don't. And their legacy is huge because they not only sell bowler hats, they sell all kinds of hats. They sold Admiral Lord Nelson his, what was it called? The bicorn.
Bicorn, sorry.
Yeah, the bicorn that he wore at the
Napoleon was the tricorn.
You don't want to confuse them. They get very offended.
But no one with a unicorn hat, which is a shame. And I think that would have made the Battle of Trafalgar really exciting.
It's really cool.
The element of surprise, I think, in the unicorn hat.
According to Lux, it was devised by a pair of people called Thomas and William Bowler. Okay, and they Edward Cook said, can you make this hat for us, to Locke, and Locke said, well, we'll get our mates Thomas and William Bowler to make it. Now, according to the OED, the bowler hat gets its name because it's shaped like a bowl, not because it's named after these guys' bowlers. So I don't want to upset the people at Locke & Co, because I'm sure their story is completely true.
Yeah.
But there is a suggestion that maybe that's nothing to do with these Thomas and William bowler people. And if you do look at the kind of newspaper archives, there was a thing called a bowl hat that existed before the bowler hat. And you can see loads of examples of people having their bowl hats stolen and stuff like that.
So did the bowlers exist for the brothers?
It feels like in fact, they definitely existed.
Okay.
Thomas and William Bowler existed. And actually, there was another guy called William Bowler who existed before them, who was a famous hat maker. So there were bowlers who were making hats for sure. But whether these guys invented the bowler hat and gave the name to it, wow, I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
It's tough. I'm really torn.
I'm not going to walk past Locke's shop in case of odd job hat comes out. Yeah. But, you know, that's...
Do you know what they have on bowler hats? The curl at the edge, which I'd actually never noticed was a fundamental feature of them.
What, on the brim?
Yeah, so there's a brim and then it curls very sharply inwards at a 40-degree angle. A little bit.
Oh,
and
really?
It's a Dorsey curl.
Okay.
And it's named after Alfred Dorsey. And this is niche, but he was basically, I think he was the Byron of France. He was apparently extremely attractive. He was the handsomest man of his time. And he was mates with Byron, in fact. And he, the other time you might have seen him, is he's the model for the New Yorker mascot. You know, if you... you know on the New Yorker,
you've got
that bloke who's actually not wearing a bowler
hat.
That's a top hat. He's,
with a
he
monocle?
Wore a number of different hats. just literally.
But that's him. His face is him, is
that's
what you're saying.
His silhouette is him.
Oh,
yeah.
A monocle?
He has got a magnifying glass, I think, and maybe a monocle.
You're thinking of Monopoly.
Mr. Monopoly is exactly what I'm thinking of. Yeah.
That was actually based on Keats.
Yeah. Apparently, according to...
glad we settled that.
No, Anna, that's a great that's great knowledge
fact,
about this Dorsey guy.
Let's connect the bowler hat to the New Yorker.
What was the link? He invented the thing on the rim.
Named after him.
The curl.
Because he was such a dandy. I guess he was a curly dandy.
Wow.
That's really cool.
It's really cool as a strong term, but it's
probably the one thing I'll remember from this podcast.
You'll be so annoyed about that.
Susie Dent wrote an amazing book about how slang is used amongst different tribes of people, so like taxi drivers and dock workers and stuff like that. And she mentions in that section that Hackney taxi cabs, the height of the cab was based on the bowler hat height for when you're getting in. It sounds a bit dubious, but I don't
know what you're saying. I didn't say anything. All I did was pull a face, and the listener didn't notice that.
No, but I think that is a rumor that's sort of out there, isn't it? That.
But how come? I thought Hackney cabs were sort of for top hats, because bowler hats don't really have any height.
That would only add another centimeter or two to the height of the cab.
Absolutely, but maybe a necessary extra centimeter.
It feels like you wouldn't redesign the whole cab.
Well, you've got quite a long torso, Andy, don't you? Or do you have long legs, actually, and a short torso?
I've got normal torso.
Oh, sorry.
I've got a normal torso, long legs, long neck, short head.
Okay.
And that's why the Murray cab, it has a lot of leg room, doesn't it?
Incredible leg room, and then a very low ceiling. Yeah.
Sorry. You know, before we were talking about bicorns, tricorns, and unicorns.
Yeah.
There is what I suppose would be a quadricorn.
No.
Cool.
And the quadricorn is a very...
That's too much surprise, Andy, sorry.
That's awesome.
The idea of a four-cornered hat does not warrant that.
I think that's incredible.
Okay. Yeah. It's up there with Alfred Dorsey.
That's the thing I'm going to remember, Anna.
I suppose the reason it's interesting is because it is related to this fact, because it's the traditional hat of the Tiwanaku people of Bolivia. And that is like a really old culture, pre-Columbian culture in Bolivia. And they had these very intricately designed four-cornered hats that sort of the rich people would wear the intricately designed ones and the poorer people wear really plain ones. But you'd have like birds' heads you would stick on there. Some of them had wings attached to them.
That's awesome.
But that sounds a bit grim. A decapitated bird's head.
Maybe. Wow. They must have done some kind of, you know, pickled it or something.
Yeah. It was a different time.
It's popular back in the day to put dead birds and things, wasn't it?
Yeah,
Valentine's cards and so on.
A full bird,
Not a death. Okay, gotcha.
Not just chopping the head off and sticking it on.
The bloodied neck sort of hanging out.
I think they'd
out.
Wipe that away. The
birds.
I think that's right. Is that where we get
like wearing a knotted handkerchief on your head at the beach from?
Absolutely
from this
not, no.
Tribe? No, okay.
That would be quite unusual for this culture to come back to life, having, you know, gone out before the Spanish came along and then travelled to 1950s seaside holidays. It would be unusual.
One of the greatest test pilots in America for wartime planes was a gorilla wearing a bowler hat, smoking a cigar.
Okay.
Okay.
And what I've done there is tricked you, because actually, it was a man.
Was your career?
Oh no, I do wonder.
Why did I allow you to say that? This is a guy called Jack Valentine Willems, and he was one of the greatest test pilots that were out there. And he used to take out planes that weren't ready; that they were. It was advanced technology.
Why would you do that?
Well, you know, you're test. He's a test pilot. He's testing.
Well, no, but it is ready, right? Ready, he's not taking a plane
ready,
with one wing.
No, but you're sorry. As in, we don't know the limits to which we can push this particular plane, so he would push it to places to see if it worked.
You just made it sound like he was sneaking into the hangar at night.
Sorry, no, they were approved flights. What he used to do, he's a bit of a practical joker, is he used to bring with him a gorilla mask, and he used to bring a polar hat and a cigar, and he would fly up to other processions of planes that were flying, and he would have that gear on, and he would wave at the other pilots. And I think, from what I've read, the idea was is that no one would believe anything about the plane, let alone the pilot, if they came and said, I saw a new plane and it was being flown by a gorilla with a cigar and a bowler hat. That sounds a bit pushed for me. I think actually he was just a practical joker. But the idea was he was going to say no one would believe that pilot existed, therefore they might not believe the plane existed that was being tested either.
It was interesting that you tried his practical joke on us, didn't you?
Yes.
Because he was trying to make people think a gorilla was flying the plane, and you also kind of made us believed it.
But it was less dangerous in this context because we're just sitting around a table, whereas I think making a prank out of putting off pilots flying actual planes is very irresponsible.
Yes.
Well, there quite a lot of comical, you know, a pilot gets so distracted they fly into a mountain.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. 400 deaths were a result of a comical flying into the mountain. Another death in the army today, and man, was it funny. We close our show with this light-hearted story.
I think I was picturing the cartoon version.
Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that there are no animals in the only zoo in Kalamazoo.
What a sad lot of children there must be in Kalamazoo.
Yeah, what a bad zoo.
What? It sounds great.
Does it?
What
is there?
It's the Air Zoo.
I see.
The Air Zoo, and the Air Zoo is a museum about aeroplanes, which has lots of planes that are named after animals.
Okay, because it does sound like the Air Zoo is what they've called it, because all the cages are just full of air.
Yeah.
like an air guitar.
You're right. It does sound like that, but actually, it's a really awesome air museum.
So planes that are named after animals. So I'm thinking immediately. I'm thinking the Sopwith Camel.
I don't know if there is one of those.
Okay.
All I know is that there's a warhawk, a goonie bird, a wildcat, a bearcat, and a hellcat.
Oh, yeah. These are very American animal plane names.
It's very American. Yeah. Kalamazoo is in the north of United States of America.
Yeah. Michigan.
In Michigan, yeah.
The Hellcat. Yeah, that's a very... The Sopwith Camel is a very British animal plane name. It's ridiculous.
Well, Goonie Bird sounds quite British as well.
I still think that's a bit of an American...
Like
you've got to see the Goonie Bird.
Hey,
you
know?
I was thinking Goon Show.
And actually on the Warhawk, sorry, you just mentioned that, the person who runs this museum, who's called Sue Parrish, she was one of the last 20 members of the Women's Air Force Service pilots from World War II who still flew planes, and she flew a bright pink Warhawk.
That's great.
Is she still alive?
She was still alive when I read an article a few years ago.
I think she's not. Yeah.
Yeah. The article actually I read was from the early 90s, so she might have died since then.
There's an airport, which is Battle Creek and Kalamazoo Airport. There's a statue of her. I believe it's at the airport. If it's not the airport, it's somewhere in the vicinity. And you can also see her plane, which is, as you said, pink, kind of cool.
Do you know it was pink, this airplane?
Oh, yes, because she only flew it when it was red sky at night, shepherd's delight in the evenings, and it was a camouflage thing.
Yeah, not far off, fairness. Just wrong, but not a million miles wrong.
I've got it. She flew only among flocks of flamingos.
Yeah.
And it was a camouflage thing.
We're getting wronger.
Okay.
It was because she's a woman and women like pink things. No, it wasn't.
Damn it.
It was because it was originally flown in Libya, these planes, and the landscape, lots of, you know, rocks and sand and quite pink sand and stuff like that. And so it just help to blend into the landscape.
Okay, so it's not hot pink.
It's not hot pink. It's quite pink.
It's pretty pink.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it looks awesome, and I think that's in the entrance when you go into the air museum, as opposed to the airport.
And after World War II, she wanted to become a commercial pilot, but she got rejection letters saying, "With your qualifications, if you were a man, we would have hired you."
Mm. Oh well, that's a nice consolation, though, isn't it?
It's awful. That's
the highest praise you can give, really.
Absolutely.
But yeah, basically, I remembered that there was a place called Kalamazoo, and I googled to see if there was a zoo there, and there isn't, but there is this place.
I didn't know anything about Kalamazoo before starting to research it, apart from, of course, the Glenn Miller song "I've Got a Girl in Kalamazoo."
Yeah.
1942,
put it on the map internationally in
but
a way,
it's named as one of those places which has a funny name and no one really knows where it is or if it's real, and it's kind of, you know, lumped in with places like Timbuktu, which have an interesting...
I wonder why. It's like,
exactly.
If you're writing songs.
Exactly. But Kalamazoo, get this. Yeah. I'm only getting in with this fact before you guys all do, because I know you'll all have it too.
Yeah.
Was the first place in the world to install dropped curbs.
Is that a curb where you can get like a buggy down, you mean? Like it goes flat?
It's as it sounds. The curb has been dropped so that you can so you can get a buggy down.
That's
or a
quite
wheelchair.
Amazing, isn't it?
I know.
Do they have a blue plaque there? They must.
Well, there are lots of claims as to what, you know, there are other cities which try and steal Kalamazoo's thunder.
Right.
They're all, I think, incorrect. I think this was the first city where you had dropped.
How deep have you had to dig for this? This is a full day's work.
there was this veteran from the Second World War called Jack Fisher, who was an advocate for both veterans and disability rights, and he trialed them. In America, they're called curb cuts, and they were first tried out here.
That's incredible.
That's cool. What year are we talking?
I think it was the late 40s or early 50s, and there are other places which tried them in the early 60s.
Yeah.
There was another thing in the 60s, and I think in America, there were some disability activists who hacked away at curbs at night and laid concrete to smooth their path.
That makes sense. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. They only did it on a few occasions in a few places. But
when you say he tested it, what's interesting about it is it feels it doesn't need testing. It feels just logical, right? It just doesn't. What did they think might go wrong?
Well, I guess it's never been done before, and he's just pointing out, look, this would make it a lot easier for lots of people to get around if you install these things. So they say, all right, well, we'll install a few, and then obviously you just see how it
I mean,
affects.
Things that can go wrong is it allows dickheads like me to pop your bike up on the pavement while you're cycling and really upset pedestrians. He didn't think of that, did he?
No.
Didn't think of that, the idiot.
I know. Same with my car.
Kalamazoo originally was called Bronson, and it was because a guy called Titus Bronson was the first white man, basically, to arrive there and set up a town there. And then, he turned it into a place where the streets were kind of named very obviously for the thing that they were operating as. So there was Church Street, where you'd have three churches on there.
Yeah.
There was the Academy, which had the college on it. There was Jail Street. Jail Street.
It makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, it makes total sense.
You know where everything is.
Yeah. I think the church one is weird, because I know that... So there's a thing in capitalism, right, where if you've got a shop that sells a certain thing, like baby clothes, then you have lots of shops in the same area. Yeah. They cluster because
like
that works.
Like the Curry Mile in Manchester with
exactly.
all the curry houses.
But churches... You rarely are like, well, we've got to fit 10 churches into this county. Shall we just put them all on the same street?
Yeah. Absolutely
true. Interesting.
The story goes that Bronson was in Detroit and he walked west into the woods, and he kept going until he got out of the woods. And this was where Kalamazoo was. Right. He walked, it's 140 miles walk till he got to any kind of clearing. There's this, we're not quite sure why, but he definitely left town at one stage. Now, he might have left town because they changed the name to Kalamazoo, or he might have left town because he stole a cherry tree and has run out of town.
There's a few
different stories, and it's not clear what's what, because if you look at contemporary reports, neither of them is mentioned. But there is a 1909 headline from the Detroit Free Press that says, because of the name of the village he founded was changed to Kalamazoo, Titus Bronson died of a broken heart. And so when they changed the name, apparently it hurt him so much that he died.
They have gone by a lot of different names. They used to be called the Celery City.
They grew a lot of celery?
They grew a lot of celery. Someone came over and grew celery there. Actually, it was a Scot, I think, called George. Apparently, George Celery Taylor, he was known as. But you never know if people were actually called that at the time.
Like the bowlers from earlier.
Like the bowl.
No, that definitely was
their name.
But that could have been like the trade that then became the name.
No, but they didn't name themselves after the hats. They were.
I'm saying we don't know.
I'm saying we do.
Ah, okay. Well, there we go.
One of the reasons that Kalamazoo is mentioned in a lot of songs. So you mentioned, who do you mention?
Glenn Miller.
Yeah. So Kalamazoo in other songs by Frank Zappa, Ben Folds, Johnny Cash, The Black Keys, who I know you like, Andy, there's Kalamazoo mentioned in there. And I think one of the reasons is because Gibson guitars were made in Kalamazoo.
Yeah.
And loads of famous people, Chuck Berry, Eric Clapton, Sheryl Crow, Bob Dylan, all people use Gibson guitars. A really interesting thing about the Gibsons is the Gibson girls. Now, during World War II, the Gibson Guitar Company was still making guitars. But the thing was, they didn't have anyone to make the guitars, right? Because all the men had gone to war. So what they did was they brought in all the local women to make these guitars, but they denied making them. And the reason being that they thought that, one, if we told people we're making guitars during the war, people would think we're being really frivolous and we shouldn't be doing this kind of thing. But secondly, they weren't sure whether people would buy guitars if they knew they were made by women.
Right.
And so they sold them as what they called new old stock. So they pretended that these were old guitars that they had in stock and they were selling during the war. We're not making them during the war, but actually all these women were doing all the work. And they also sometimes said that they were made by seasoned craftsmen who were too old for war.
Yeah, right.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, not brilliant, obviously. Sorry.
It's good. You can appreciate the marketing.
Oh, yeah.
Did the women who were making them leave any kind of clues as to the fact that they like, inside done. Did they
drop
write?
A tampon into the body of the guitar?
Used tampon in just rattling around.
That was the key to their individual sound, actually.
Just a couple more things on Kalamazoo. Notable person from there, William Shakespeare Jr. And what I did there was trick you to make you think
it was actually a gorilla.
It's actually a gorilla. He's William Shakespeare Jr. He was an inventor, quite a notable inventor there. So he was around in the 1800s, and he invented what's known as the Shakespeare fishing tackle, which is a really big thing that's still used today. Do you know it?
No, I'm just trying to think of a pun.
Me too.
Fishing tackle, lots of innovations of that sort. He had patents for camera equipment and so
that
on.
Casting? No.
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking of,
you can say whatever you want now for the next 5 minutes.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to debate. It's not working. Okay, no, I've joined now. Anna, you take over.
God, astonishing. You run through his plays, there are almost no fish puns.
It's bad, isn't it?
Yeah.
A Midsummer Night's Bream.
Very good.
Nice, there you go.
Nice. There we go.
God.
Can we move on? Is that?
Nope.
Okay, we're still doing it.
Go on, Andy.
Mackerel Beth. No.
No, that's nice. That's
bad.
Great.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Yeah. As you pike it.
Oh,
very nice.
Lovely.
Bloody hell, have you guys all got one? Oh, gosh.
If you have one at home, then why not send it to at Andrew Hunter M.
Okay, it is time for fact number 3, and that is Andy.
My fact is that some American gravestones feature recipes.
Yummy. Of how to cook the human below it?
Yes. This is a thing that happens sometimes in the States. the original wording of the fact was lots of American gravestones contain recipes, and it was pointed out that there are about 11 so far. There was a query over whether that's technically lots or not, which is fair. But there are people who, who've made it their hobby to track down all gravestones which feature recipes and bake them up. And it's especially big on places like TikTok. There are lots of grave people on TikTok, and they're nicknamed tapophiles, which is people who love graves and cemeteries. And
is that what is on TikTok? Because I haven't been on TikTok. I didn't realize it was that. I thought it was like dancing and stuff.
It's not all of TikTok. Yeah, there's there's a lot. Again, when I say lots of people on TikTok do it, some people on TikTok. Okay. It's more effort than filming a dance. But it's really interesting.
TikTok tapophiles is a nice alliteration, isn't it? Yeah. Worth becoming one.
Yeah. And these grave recipes are some of them date back, you know, decades or further than that.
I just thought, like, TikTok, it's like, what do you call that thing that reminds you of death?
The pendulum. It's the like Reaper,
Memento Mori,
yeah. Isn't it? So whenever you think about TikTok,
is it a very morbid place, TikTok?
I think
is it
so.
One big Memento Mori?
It's just thinking about the number of seconds you have left.
Yeah, and the number of seconds you spent watching this crap.
Wow. So
people are doing it on making up the recipes and then showing them on their TikTok videos, right?
Yeah, people are going around doing that.
And any examples?
Well, there's a lovely fudge recipe. Oh. There is blueberry pie. There's yeast cake. But it doesn't always work. Sometimes there was one gravestone which had a typo in the recipe on it.
Oh, no.
I know. And it would have made very runny fudge if you made it according to that. But thankfully...
What was the typo? I want to know what typo is that makes runny fudge.
It was too much vanilla.
Oh, really?
So it said tablespoon as opposed to teaspoon, I believe.
Not going to make it that runny, is it? Just that's not much difference.
It's not like
a kilogram versus a gram. Because you don't put much vanilla in a fudge recipe, do you? It's just a tiny amount.
Well, that's why. Because if you do a tablespoon, apparently it turns out vapor. Anyway, they corrected the entire gravestone off the back of that, which is
really?
A relief.
Why would you... Yeah. I'm trying to work out why you would do it.
Do what? Put a recipe on?
Yeah.
Well, people like to be creative on their gravestones, right? It's a really fun thing. And passing down your great recipe, I think.
I think that's what it is. I think it's something that matters to you, something that's traditional, a recipe you might have inherited from the generation above you.
People like to pass on recipes to the next generation, don't they? And
I guess there's very little you can pass on. You could pass on, like... a series of dance moves. I'm trying to think of something else you might pass on to the next generation, but you're right, recipes are probably it.
Dance moves on your grave. It's encouraging people to dance on your grave.
You can have a set of those footprint outlines
like they have in Japan. I was thinking, like, you know those games that you play in Japan where you can
dance, the arcade games.
They light up.
I was just thinking I'd like mine to be kind of like that mole whacker game, so you put a coin into the grave and then my head pops out from one of the you gotta slam it with a hammer, then my arm comes out another, and then my leg.
You'll be so annoyed if you're one of those people who wasn't actually dead and tries to escape from your grave and it'd be constantly malleted down.
Guys, no, seriously. But I think it's great. I mean, there are so many gravestones around the world where people, as their sort of like last wish, have said, can you make this happen? And people do, and they're beautiful. And I read a great one. There was a 99-year-old woman who in Mexico, her dying wish was for her gravestone to be made according to what she loved most in life. And so she got it. It was a 600-pound, 5-foot-tall penis. Just a giant penis.
That's what she loved in life, a 5-foot penis.
She loved calling people dicks in life, apparently, and that's what she asked for. And I've seen the video of them unveiling it. It looks like it's got a giant condom over the top of it, which is then removed. It's a huge pink penis, like 5'5".
But unfortunately, if you're in Libya, you couldn't see it.
The testicles, apparently, they really had a lot of problem with because the ball sack apparently kept just disfiguring during the melting process of the actual materials, which was, I believe, plastic. And so they had to, like, build the testicles quite a few times. And they're big balls when you see it. So it's sort of standing up.
Right.
Anyway.
Is it a churchyard or a cemetery?
Yeah, it's in a cemetery.
But surrounded by other... I can imagine being slightly annoyed if I had the grave next door.
Totally. Absolutely.
Well, by that time, you can't be annoyed.
No, it's true. Okay, sorry.
I know you're an easily annoyed person, Andy, but I reckon that after death, you're not going to be under there going...
He will.
If I can, I will.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's what it's going to say on his tombstone. Just.
I'm so with you though. If I was a relative of someone who'd been buried next to that, I would find that irritating.
But this is what happens a lot in the UK. Certainly, so many graves are the traditional, whether it's slate or normally it's grey stone and it's carved and it's all down to the individual church or individual local authority. And so there's this mad, if you want something out of the ordinary, you might get it approved, but you really might not.
Well, like shape-wise, like a big penis.
Well, shape-wise and colour-wise, and there are rules about what you can and can't carve. But there's no one authority in the UK which tells you.
It feels
what you
like
can
we should
get.
Have that, and it does feel reasonable to say no penises.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe call me old-fashioned.
I agree. Yeah, definitely.
Well, on that and gravestones, there's an amazing cemetery in Paris, the Père Lachaise Cemetery, and it's got loads of good graves in it. But one of them's the grave of Victor Noir, who was a 19th century journalist. And he wasn't that famous in his lifetime. I think he was shot by Napoleon Bonaparte's nephew in 1870.
Okay.
And loads of people suddenly went to his funeral because it became this kind of political cause. But for some reason, we don't know why, his effigy, so on his gravestone is a big bronze effigy of him lying down. Mm. It has a bulge in his crotch.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Like quite tight trousers, lovely big penis bulge. And what's so rank about it is that it's a bit like, there's Greyfriars Bobby in Edinburgh, the famous dog statue, and everyone always rubs its nose for luck, so that's really shiny.
Yeah,
and in the same way, everyone keeps rubbing and mounting and writhing against this crotch, so it's incredibly shiny.
Oh,
and not only that, it's not just the crotch, but his lips and nose.
Well, they kiss his lip. Yeah, they kiss his lips.
I know.
What do they do to his nose?
But what, yeah. I mean, that's because that's not just rubbing. They've mounted fully.
Yeah. It's a fertility thing. It's you go and you do that if
people
you want to get pregnant.
People say that, but it's not. It's people going for a joke. Everyone's like, they do it for... This is 20th century. This is people going to France and going...
It's for Instagram, isn't it? There is a sign that says, any damage caused by graffiti or indecent rubbing will be prosecuted.
Oh.
It's all indecent rubbing.
What's decent rubbing? That's actually a better question.
But I always think with these, they would be the best place for like a zombie apocalypse to start, where there's loads of famous people.
That would be a great film.
Or like Westminster Abbey, that's where you want your zombie apocalypse to start, isn't it? Where all the famous people are buried.
Yeah. I think Jim Morrison is in the one you were just talking about as well.
Perfect.
I believe. That's really good.
Because that's a good mix. Westminster Abbey is all a bit like royals and nobles, isn't it?
Yeah.
But if you went to this one, you get rock stars, you get authors, you get weirdos.
More like the doors to hell have opened.
Yes.
Great.
Yes, more like
cool.
that. Yeah, yeah.
You've redeemed yourself. Fishgate is forgotten.
Speaking, as we were earlier, of people doing inappropriate things in graveyards.
Yeah.
Do you guys know about the bustuarii?
No.
They were sex workers in Rome in the first century AD, and they plied their trade in cemeteries.
Oh, naughty.
Yeah, so in the daytime, they were professional mourners. Okay, but in the nighttime, they were sex workers, and they would write on the gravestones what their prices and stuff like that.
They used them like phone boxes.
A little bit, and people would go, and they had very pale skin and severe expressions, and they were kind of quite gothic looking in and of themselves. There was one called Noctina, who would sleep on the graves and cover her eyes with coins. And then they were also prostitutes.
That feels like she's encouraging some worrying kinks there.
I'm afraid that there was some of that. If you read Martial, Juvenal and Catullus all talk about it, and apparently there was some of this.
Bloody hell.
The fact that they're professional mourners in the daytime. That's sort of, and then at nighttime, basically the mourning garb comes off.
Saucy. And then in the morning garb goes back on.
Oh, yeah. Mm. They had this weird thing in Roman tombs, which were called libation tubes. Have you heard of this?
No.
This is so cool. These are terracotta tubes that go down into the grave from ground level, and they're deliberately so you can give the dead a drink.
You go into them.
Yeah, it was just a pipeline right down to the mouth of the dead.
Was that different to the sausage one, the sausage pipe?
I don't remember the sausage pie. We did talk about that.
That rings such a vague bell.
Yeah. Was there a sausage pie?
John Bonderson wrote about it in Buried Alive. Yeah, I think that the idea was if you were buried alive, you had a string that you pulled and it would ring a bell and they would come and get you and say, we're coming to get you out, but here, have a sausage until then. And they would pop a sausage, then the sausage pie, so you had some sustenance while
cooked.
They were...
A cooked sausage.
It doesn't say. I assume a cooked sausage.
It must be.
You don't want to give them food poisoning while they're down there.
Tragic, he died of botulism while we were getting the spade. A fast-acting lethal sausage. You know PETA, the animal rights organisation?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They did a thing a few years ago. They bought a tombstone in a cemetery for one of their colleagues. It was called Matt Prescott. But it was they bought a tombstone in a very specific place. They bought it right near Colonel Sanders.
Tombstone. Yeah, yeah.
And it had a message on it. It was a little poem that they'd written for their colleague Matt. And it was an acrostic. And the first letter of every line spelled out the phrase KFC tortures birds.
Wow.
I know.
My favourite gravestone is an acrostic. It's awesome. It's for a guy called John Rene, R-E-N-I-E, Rene or Rene. Okay. And what it says on it is it says, here lies John Rene. But then it says it basically 45,760 times in total, because it's an acrostic that goes 19 squares across and 15 squares down. Mm-hmm. And everywhere you start reading it, you can make here lies John Rene along this box of it.
And, oh, cool.
And the total that you can add it up to is, 45,000.
So it's like the second line, it reads, here lies John Rene. Like that, doesn't
kind of
it?
Thing.
And then
yeah.
the next one is slightly different, the next one's slightly different. So you can read it down diagonally.
Exactly.
Like the world's most boring word search.
So yes. Cool.
Which is cool. Great. It's an amazing thing to look at.
Oh, well, the guy who first formulated pi to 35 places was a German mathematician called Ludolf van Soylen. And his gravestone reads 3.141595265358979323283.
And what is that if it isn't a recipe for pie?
Okay, it is time for our final fact of the show, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that doctors used to prepare their patients for surgery by either getting them really drunk or smacking them on the head with a mallet and hoping they didn't kill them. That's back in the day. So
which day are we talking?
This is in the 1800s. This was in the top floor of America's oldest surgical amphitheater, as it's known. This is in the Pennsylvania Hospital. And I guess what's so surprising is how late in the day this was happening. This is in the sort of mid-1800s.
Because mid-1800s was when I take a lot of credit, but we had got like some ether, chloroform, and stuff was starting to happen.
And a lot of them weren't fully accepted, though. So it definitely was around at this time, hospital was like, not into it. We'd rather hit you on the head. It
happened in Britain as well. There was a guy called Henry Hill Hickman who used to try suffocation to get his patients conscious.
So this was a thing. And, you know, the drunkenness hopefully would see them through an operation, as would such a massive hit on the head.
Some of these operations were very quick, weren't they? They were amputations and stuff, and they were trying to do them in a matter of seconds, really.
In fact, that seems to be the most effective method of painkilling up until, you know, they found ether and stuff, was just speed. And there was, we talked about
drug.
QI.
You'd love it.
Just gets people incredibly anxious before the operation. Doing it within a short amount of time. And we've mentioned Robert Liston on QI, but he was a famous 19th century surgeon, and his catchphrase was, time me, gentlemen, time me. And there's a huge amount of showmanship to his surgical performances.
It's a good catchphrase, that.
It's a good catchphrase. Yeah. And it would kind of reassure you. If you're having your leg cut off, you want it to be quick. And he used to brag he could amputate a leg in 25 seconds.
Wow.
And his chances of dying, because he gets a lot of stick these days for being all about the show and less about the safety.
Uh-huh.
But you only had a 1 in 6 chance of dying, quite good for surgeons then. Mm. And there was one the best story about him, which I'm pretty sure we looked at when we did QI, and is probably not true, but it was reported that he once... was so focused on doing something incredibly fast that he's amputating a limb, and he accidentally at the same time cut through his associate nurse's finger
right.
on the way. And so both the person whose limb was amputated and the person whose finger he amputated died pretty quickly afterwards. Oh. And also someone who was watching died of shock. And it's always recorded as the only operation with a 300% mortality rate.
Yeah. Wow.
So it's a great story.
It's a strong story.
Don't check it ever.
Yeah. That's a comical ending. Like an airplane going into a mountain. That's comical surgery.
That's comedy, you're right. Yeah.
Just on the sort of reputation of surgery back in the day.
Yeah.
This is a fact actually got sent in to us from Sarah on Twitter. So thank you, Sarah. It was about the operating theatre in Aberdeen.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And there used to be above the door to the operating theatre in Aberdeen the words, "Prepare to meet thy God." Which is just such an uncheerful thing to read.
Wow.
And it was all about this surgeon called Alexander Ogston who worked there, and he discovered Staphylococcus, which is a very big
common bacteria for getting like
infections and abscesses and pus and all of that, and really dangerous Staphylococcus. And he was so inspired by antiseptic zeal that he returned and he pulled the sign down and burned it on one occasion.
Wow.
Because it was a very religious place to have your operation.
I can imagine. So the one that I was talking about in Pennsylvania, the surgery itself had a sky roof, basically. So there was a dome at the top and it was glass.
Ooh, nice.
So they would do all the operations in the day and natural light was what was giving their light.
Lovely.
Yeah.
But at night the surgeons will take off their robes and they'll show you a good time.
Yeah.
They would write their prices on the patient's spleen. They did have anesthetics before then, various types throughout the world. A Chinese physician called Hua Tuo, I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong, apologies if I am, but from 140 AD to 208 AD, this guy, he would use something called Mafeisan, which is cannabis boil powder. So he gave it to the patient. And apparently it was so good, there was a guy called General Kuan Yu, and he was wounded by a poisoned arrow, and he was sort of given some surgery to try and bring the arrow out and clean the wound. And the general played chess while his bone was being scraped clean.
Wow.
Because his concoction was so good.
Wow. But did he win the game?
He just kept whacking the pieces off because he was in so much pain. No.
Yeah, we still don't know how they work.
Yeah, crazy, eh?
I find there's so much of medicine we don't know how or why it works. It's just we kept trying and this one stuck. I mean, people speculate that this is general anesthetic, so what puts you to sleep. Speculated that it dissolves some of the fat in your brain cells, so stops the cells' activity. There's just been a study that found out that one particular anesthetic maybe weakens the transmission of electrical signals between your neurons in like the higher functioning parts of your brain. So that's why it will knock you unconscious, but it won't stop you breathing because the lower functioning parts can still keep going. But yeah, it's so weird that we just accept it works. But I like before another anesthetic.
I don't know how my microwave works.
But someone does.
Yeah. That's true.
Sorry, when I say we, I don't just mean we couldn't be asked to research it. I mean, even the scientists can't be asked to find out properly. But another ancient way of anesthetizing people was electric rays, which.
Like
fish, yeah. Right. So these were used in ancient Rome. It was like torpedo fish, I think we've talked about before, could give you a real electric shock. And it was treatment for gout, or it was if you wanted to numb an area and you needed to do something to it. Wow. It was recommended that you stand on the shore and you let your legs be washed by the sea as various electric rays wrapped themselves around it and wait for them to electrify you.
If you were just stood in the sea, you would need to... You need to bring them to you, right? They wouldn't just naturally sting
you. Yeah, how are you attracting them?
Yeah.
Maybe you drop some food for them. No, wait, are you the food?
You are, well, kind of. You could maybe cut your legs so there's a bit of blood in the water.
Yeah, nice. Then awful if the shark comes before the eels. And then it's just whole thing amputated.
It's not convenient, though.
So they would shock you. You would go numb. They would carry you out and then...
And then they can do a treatment on you, like cut off
like
a bunion.
Like cut off your legs.
Bunion.
All that for a bunion, my God.
Yeah.
Jesus.
You know how in the very first episode of this podcast, we talked about Anyone remember?
President Garfield's anus.
So I have a related fact to this.
Yeah. I think you should quickly explain that for anyone who can't remember 460 episodes ago.
So this is the fact that for the last, was it month of his life?
3 months, I believe.
3 months. President Garfield ate everything through his anus, and that's because he'd been shot and he wasn't able to eat through the mouth, and so he was fed through the bum. So the American president usually hands over power when...
Yes, he does. But in Donald Trump's case...
You're so right. Donald Trump is the outlier here. Okay, James, that's exactly right. So, okay, normally when the US president, always a man so far, has a colonoscopy, which is a procedure. Oh, yeah. If you're a bit older, they put a camera up your bum and they just check what's going on. Normally a small camera on a little wire, not like a big long lens paparazzi camera. And it's a very common thing, you know. So Joe Biden did it in 2021, handed over to Kamala Harris for the, you know, like half an hour, a couple of hours of the anesthetic. George Bush had it twice, and both times handed over briefly to Dick Cheney. There was a report a year or so ago that Donald Trump underwent this procedure, but he refused to have the anesthetic because he didn't want to hand over to Mike Pence, however briefly, the reins of office. So he just sort of barebacked it.
God, I know. One chance they thought they had to silence Donald Trump for a couple of blissful hours.
That's really interesting. I've got that's another thing about putting stuff up the bum.
Oh, yeah.
If you want to hear it. So this is about the first woman physician to specialise in anaesthesia, who's called Isabella Herb. And she was the first person to use ethylene as a general anaesthetic. And there were two main ways that she'd get you out of the anaesthesia state. One of them was to give you strychnine, which would apparently help, presumably not that much. And the other one was the installation of warm saline solutions to the rectum.
Installation. Such a gentle term.
So if you were under because of this ethylene, then she would squirt some salty water up your bum and it would get you out of the...
Sounds kind of pleasant. Although, is that not the thing that makes you wet yourself? No, that's finger
I think
there.
That's putting your hand in a bowl of water, not squirting.
I bet if you put your bum in it, though, it something happens.
Does. And the interesting thing about ethylene and a problem that she had was that it does explode quite easily. And so what she did was she had her operating theatre and they had very, very high humidity because apparently that helps you because there's slightly less oxygen in the air, so less likely to explode. But also because it was an early time of having electric lights and stuff like that, they grounded everything in the building. So the table where the person was being operated on, and in fact, everyone kind of had things attached to them. Do you remember we talked about this big spike that people had on their heads?
Yeah, everyone had electrical conductors to conduct the charge.
So basically, everyone was wearing these wires to, and they attached to the pipes around the room, the water pipes, so that if there was any kind of spark in there, instead of setting off the ethylene, it would go into these grounded things and then go down into the building. Isn't that amazing?
That's really
good.
Isabella Herb as well. What a great name.
Imagine, you know, when you fill in the forms before you do an operation where you say, I understand that I might blah, blah, and blah, blah. Imagine just that, well, I understand there's a 30% chance I'll explode. Just on doctors sort of beating patients around us, this mallet people did in the fact. August Beer was the first person who came up with the first spinal anaesthesia. That was in the 1890s, 1898. And so that was injecting cocaine into your spinal cord, was the first spinal anaesthesia. And he wanted to work out how much you really needed to inject, because if you injected too much, had bad side effects. And so he thought, okay, well, I'm going to test it out on myself. And so he asked his assistant, also called August, to inject him.
The fun they must have had.
The two August, having a very non-August time. And so his assistant injected his spine. Sadly, his spinal fluid started leaking out quite drastically, and so they had to stop. So he said, do you mind if we swap? So the August swapped, and his assistant said, okay, well, you try it on me. So August, the assistant, lies there, and August Beer jabs him with the cocaine and then tests how high his pain threshold is. And the account is just incredible. So he starts by tickling his feet, quite pleasant, couldn't feel anything. And then he jabbed a large blunt needle into his thigh. And then he got a larger, blunter needle and put it in down his femur, apparently. He's awake through this process because local anaesthetic. So he's chatting away and having a great time.
Yeah.
He got sharp forceps and crushed his skin up.
Oh, God.
He burned a cigar out on him. He yanked all his pubic hair off. And then just...
In one go?
That was just for fun, wasn't it?
He actually, he'd asked for a wax and you might as well. Two birds, one stone. He actually yanked his pubic hair off and then did the chest hair for comparison.
Right.
Just to say, see, it would hurt if, you know, if you weren't anaesthetized.
Wow.
Hit his shin with a hammer, squeezed his testicles very hard, and said, look, how impressive is that?
I think he compressed his testicles between two plates, didn't he? And then just kept squeezing.
Did he?
I remember reading about this, yeah.
Gosh.
Well, they'd had a big feast afterwards, so maybe they ate off the testicle plates.
Oh, my God. And what, so afterwards, was it just broken?
How did that go for you?
Oh, it's absolutely fine. He was a bit bruised as it wore off, but he was. They wined and dined and cigared together, and
God, I would let cigars anywhere near me after that.
Some people wake up in the middle of a general anaesthetic, and it sounds awful. No, the good thing is you almost always forget afterwards. So I spoke to someone who carries out anaesthesia quite regularly and says sometimes patients get chatty during procedures. And you could just tell them to shut up and be really rude to them because they won't remember after the operation. One patient had been going on and on about their job, I think, at NatWest and how interesting it was. And they just had to say, look,
that's
could you shut up, please?
That's so funny because when I last had general anaesthesia, I thought, I'll just have a chat because I've not met an anaesthesia expert before. And I just started chatting to him and then went under.
Right.
And now I'm realising that... As soon as I went under, he's like, you boring bastard.
You woke up with no pubes, right? But so normally you don't remember it, but sometimes you do remember it and you can't move because the drugs are paralysing you.
Sounds
that
terrifying.
Sounds like the worst thing in the world because you wake up, you know what's going on and you can't do anything about it.
And all you can hear is the anaesthetist going, oh, I shagged your mum. Yeah.
Fenella woke up after she had surgery where she went under general anaesthetic and she woke up and was quite tired and they didn't realise that she was awake. This is post-surgery. Mm. They were moving her away and all she heard was a conversation about how much the doctors enjoyed No Such Thing as a Fish.
What the worst possible nightmare. Yeah.
She was like, oh, Christ.
I would put you back under.
Okay, that's it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we've said over the course of this podcast, we can be found on our Twitter accounts. I'm on @Schreiberland. Andy.
@AndrewHunterM.
James.
@JamesHarkin.
And Anna.
You can email podcast.qi.com.
Yep, you can go to our group account, which is @NoSuchThing, or our website, NoSuchThingAsAFish.com. Check out all the previous episodes from No Such Thing as a Fish. They're all up there. You can also find your way into Club Fish. There's lots of bonus content up there. Check it out. It's really awesome. And otherwise, just come back here to our free podcast that comes out every week. We'll be back again next week with another one. We'll see you then. Goodbye.